This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we meet some refugees who have recently moved to Port Townsend and learn why we might soon expect many more. So now, let's go inside the Compass. All right, so tell me your names, please.
Oh, I'm Matt Harder.
And?
Susan Harder.
And you, I understand, have just moved here from Boston. Why did you come to Port Townsend?
Well, we had that 110 inches of snow in Boston last winter. And I came out to Seattle on business in between the third and the fourth blizzard there. And it was green grass everywhere and flowering bushes. And some guy was mowing his lawn in shorts. And I called up Matt and said, you know, we're idiots. Why do we live on the East Coast?
So it was climate that brought you here.
It just makes everything so hard, you know, living in a climate like that. You know, there's a period in the winter where when I came back from that Seattle trip, my car was gone because it was just buried in the snow. And I started digging it out, and then I realized there's nowhere to put the snow. You know, I had to walk about 20 feet with each shovelful and throw it 12 feet in the air on top of a pile and then walk back. And then I thought, what am I doing? Once I dig the car out, I can't take it anywhere. As soon as I leave the spot downtown, someone's just going to steal it, and then I won't have anywhere to park the car and don't have anywhere to go anyway. And it just got kind of grim. You know, there's maybe a good 4 or 5 months where we didn't see any green, and I'm 6'4", and the snow was up to my shoulders, and our daughter was just kind of disappeared when she walked down the sidewalk. You know, it was just hard. Everything seemed hard. Yeah.
So what is your name, please?
My name is Dylan Ibsen.
And Dylan, I understand that you've recently moved to Port Townsend, is that right?
Yeah, I just moved up here about 3.5 months ago, actually.
And what brought you up here? Where did you move from?
I moved from the hellhole of California.
The hellhole of California? What part of California is that?
The whole part of it. No, that would be the Central Valley. I fled California to enjoy the weather that Washington has to offer.
So it sounds like you must have left some pretty serious community behind. I mean, that's a big decision, isn't it?
Yeah, it is definitely a big decision. But what swayed me to do the move is the community that I was moving to up here.
It couldn't have been much more than an hour between the time I met Matt and Susan Harder at the bicycle parking area near the Point Hudson entrance to the Wooden Boat Festival and the time I met young Dylan Ibsen inside the show down by the corn booth. In the course of our conversations, I was struck by the similarities in their stories and the fit with what my realtor friend Terry Nomura had told me more than a year ago, that Port Townsend has become a favored destination for a growing number of climate refugees. I decided to go and talk to Nomura again about the matter and met up with her a few days later at her office on Water Street in downtown Port Townsend. She started out by noting that people, including her own family, which moved here decades ago to avoid Minneapolis's freezing winters and muggy summers, have always sought out better climes for their homes, but then admitted that climate change has recently made such moves much more urgent.
Everything appears to be accelerating. I mean, in my point of view, it looks like we're having more problems worldwide. And I don't know if that's scientifically accurate. It just feels like it is. I mean, I lived in Florida. We had hurricanes there, no question. But people weren't leaving Florida because of the hurricanes. But now, with Hurricane Katrina, people had to leave New Orleans. You know, there wasn't a question whether or not they should leave. They didn't have a home or a place to go back to.
Right.
So there were definitely climate refugees that left there. And now, say like in Phoenix, this summer was like over 110, commonly. Well, what does that mean? You really can't go outside, you know?
Yeah.
You just can't. You're going to be a fried egg, you know? So then what you do is say, oh, well, I think I could go to the Northwest for the summer and not be in this heat. And then I can come back in the wintertime when it's not so extreme. So
what's going on with it? What's the trend with real estate in Port Townsend right now? I haven't looked up the statistics, but I've heard anecdotally that like prices are rising.
Prices are rising. The real estate market is, I'd say, hot. You know, so we're selling things. We're buyers are suffering. I mean, so it's almost a seller's market. You know, so buyers are suffering in that they can't find something that they want.
You're meeting people who are coming to town looking for places. Are they talking about the weather, or are they like saying, "I'm moving here because it's just too damn hot in Phoenix"? I mean, is that
comes up? Yeah, or water. How about water? I mean, we had a drought year, but how about California water? I mean, that's some serious water problems. And they're saying, yeah, I like the idea of having a little stream on my property because then I know that there's something there, you know, and I could drink.
How about wildfire?
How about wildfire? Yeah. How about not being able to go to your house because you're surrounded by fire? And we had that in Eastern Washington. It was very frightening. Yeah. So, yeah, I have had people say, yeah, we would like to move to your area because my area is getting too hard for me to be there. And I had one client in Northern California, sort of mid-state, and she needed to stay at her house during the fire season, which hasn't let up, because she had to be there to be vigilant for her house. She couldn't leave it and come look at property. So it's serious. Yeah, it's definitely serious.
My conversation with Terry Nomura put me in mind of the person who is without doubt Port Townsend's most prominent and outspoken climate refugee, award-winning journalist Dar Jamal, who moved here with his wife Erica a little more than a year ago to escape suffocating heat and wildfires in Texas. I invited Jamal over to set Port Townsend's climate refugee situation into a more global perspective. You moved to Port Townsend a little more than a year ago, explicitly saying that you were coming here as a climate refugee. Could you tell me a little bit more about that decision?
Yeah, the decision was largely based on looking at, okay, I'm in my mid-40s and looking at the climate models for the rest of the United States. What are the best places to live as far as water availability, land's capability of supporting growing food and staying out of large urban population centers just for having a life worth living situation. And you know, Port Townsend and, you know, the general Northwest region, but specifically this part of the Olympic Peninsula looked, you know, this in the far, far Northeast looked like some of the best places to do so. And so I looked at some other areas in the Southwest and in the South and, you know, looking at climate models, those are just simply not places where you're going to want to be. And, you know, what we've seen over the last year in those regions confirms that as far as record-setting droughts to record-setting floods to record-setting rainfalls to, you know, biblical level apocalyptic floods around Texas and things like this. And so while, you know, up here, we don't exactly have an easy going. We look at the fires impacting us and the droughts, but it's less severe than it is in other places. And so from that lens, that was one of the leading factors as to why I decided this would be a good place to live.
Although in California, the wildfires have been apocalyptic as well. I mean, this morning's New York Times had the story about Middletown, which is burning up.
Yeah, they are as we speak. Actually, this morning of our interview, I spent starting another one of my climate dispatches that will be running soon on Truth Out and talking about how Governor Jerry Brown has declared a state of emergency for the state of California because of the wildfires. I mean, in July alone, they spent nearly $250 million just fighting wildfires. And now here we are midway through September and, you know, there's soot and ash from massive wildfires in Middletown, which is about 90 miles from the Bay Area. There's soot and ash from those fires falling in the Bay Area. And so it's really amazing to just look around and see, you know, this is kind of almost Hollywood drama action movie level of development that we're seeing in relation to climate disruption.
It seems to me like everything around climate disruption just is moving faster and faster. And it's kind of like all of the predictions that we heard for some distance out there are actually arriving here now. And some of those kind of beyond the tipping point events, like wildfires, that start spilling more and more carbon into the atmosphere, are happening more and more frequently. Is that your perception as well? I mean, you're reporting on this all the time. So, I mean, how are we doing in terms of those benchmarks just since a year ago when we seem to have exceeded them all already?
Well, as you just described it, I think that's precise what you just said, that we keep seeing reality actually surpass the worst case predictions. I mean, already we see, you know, just from my writing, my climate dispatch from last month to this month, it's confirmed that 2015 is going to be, from what climate scientists even just today have said, this will be by far the warmest year ever recorded on the planet. And then we're going to see, since record keeping began, and then just yesterday, the UK's Met Office said that 2016 and 2017 are for sure going to be the two hottest years also that we've ever seen. So we're seeing the hockey stick graph. We're living in it. We're literally going straight up through the roof on all predictions, whether it's the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere or record-setting heat or record-setting droughts or other extreme weather events, melting in the Arctic, melting in the Antarctic. Things are happening at paces that are surpassing even a lot of the worst-case predictions. Well, certainly all of the worst-case predictions from the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And so, you know, we're living in that. And I think it's a challenging thing for, I think, all of us to get our heads around that, because I myself, like, you know, it's part of me, even despite being steeped in doing this research and writing about it on a regular basis, I think there's this part of me that thinks, well, if it's not like Hollywood level drama of, you know, running from your life from a flood or a fire or something, then, you know, maybe it's just not that bad. But, you know, in reality, we are seeing it. We are seeing the levels of drama that there are actually millions of people around the world already living that. And, you know, we're looking about, as far as climate change refugees within the U.S., where it's less dramatic, where people of privilege like myself, you know, I have the capability to move and enough money to do so and make these choices and not doing it in an emergency situation, to what we're seeing in Europe now, where there's literally millions of people now going, trying to get to countries where, simply because there's food and water there and something like security, because where they used to live, those things no longer exist.
But now, nominally, those people, though, are escaping political instability. Right, but you're looking at it and seeing climate refugees.
Both. We have to look below what's causing the political instability, and we can again cite the so-called Arab Spring as the primary example, or look at Egypt. You know, it's in Syria. It's actually been shown, I think, pretty extensively by now, that the origins of the conflict both in Syria and Egypt stemmed from unrest among the general population, which started to destabilize the political machine in both of those countries. Unrest from high food prices, lack of water, lack of basic infrastructure, things like power and things like this. And, you know, these all came in the wake or as a result of extended droughts in both of those regions. So you're not growing enough food, food prices go up, the general population, which is already, you know, we have overpopulation problems, especially in Egypt. There's just not enough resources to go around. And we're talking about basic food and water for the general population. So then people, you know, there's unrest, there starts to be demonstrations, and even governments being overthrown. And that's what basically sparked the entire Arab Spring. And we look at the chronic conflict now in Syria, in Iraq, I think we can point to similar things. When there's just not basic services available and food and water for people, it's going to cause political instability. So, yes, the refugee crisis now besetting Europe is from, it's, you know, you can attribute it to, well, there's an unstable political situation in their countries, and that is definitely accurate, but we have to take it a step further and look at, well, what's causing that political instability. And I see it all now through the lens of climate disruption. Is what's causing that climate, that political instability, is lack of basic things like food and water, and that's coming from droughts, wildfires, record heat waves, and things like this, which are all coming from climate disruption.
Well, speaking of political instability, let's turn back and look at the United States. We're coming up to an election year here. And what's your prediction in terms of the importance of climate change in this election? And How tenable do you think it's going to be for, I mean, I know that the Republicans are already sort of changing their tune a bit and moving from sort of out-and-out denial of climate change to saying things like, well, I'm not a scientist and I don't know what's going on. But do you think that's going to hold water next year with all of the stuff that's happening this year?
I think climate disruption is now and will forever be the single most important issue politically in this and every other country on the planet. The question is, how much is that going to be recognized by the various candidates and the people in various power positions? I mean, we continue to see this total disconnect in this almost like bipolar behavior. If like Obama goes to Alaska, okay, we're going to rename Denali. We're going to talk about climate change. We're going to go look at melting glaciers and talk about how important this is as a political topic. And at the same time, we're going to talk about, you know, getting drilling going up in the Arctic and off the coasts of Alaska and things like this. So I don't really see that kind of disconnect and kind of crazy behavior politically going away. Certainly with elections coming up, I would expect it to increase. Unless some candidate like Bernie Sanders or someone that is directly addressing the issue actually came into power and could actually do it. And now whether or not they're able to come into power is a completely different question and not the subject of this discussion. But this is the most critical topic facing the planet today, bar none. And nothing short of making it thus and taking appropriate actions on every level, and whether that means government mandated, we're going to start cutting down immediately the availability and use of fossil fuels, to major shifts from dumping money into the military to pouring it into development on a broad scale of wind, solar, and other types of renewable energies and things like this. I mean, nothing short of that makes any sense whatsoever. So that just leaves the open-ended question of what candidate is going to really approach it that way, which I think would be the only realistic and honest way to approach this crisis.
Well, and if things continue the way they've been going, I mean, we're going to have our own refugee crisis here pretty soon, wouldn't you think?
Absolutely. I think whether it's this coming presidential election or at the latest, the following presidential election, the ability of politicians of any political persuasion to avoid the topic of human-caused climate disruption is just not going to be possible. I mean, the events on the ground in extreme weather events to refugee crises, are becoming so severe and so regular that it's literally going to be an impossible topic for people to avoid addressing and coming up with some kind of a strategy around. And especially here where by, again, I think three years from now, we're going to have our own European-style refugee crisis where all the climate projections and what's happening on the ground already throughout Central America and Mexico as far as drought, lack of water for agriculture, and all issues around that, extreme weather events, storms, record-setting flooding, et cetera, is to the point where we're going to see refugees coming up through those areas into the southern part of the country. We're going to have a crisis, I think, that this country's never had to deal with before. People literally trying to move simply because they don't have enough food and water in their own countries. And that's also something that I mentioned, the Pentagon report, that's a thing that they're preparing for, how to deal with it. So I think that this is a crisis that we're going to see right here, right? And, you know, that's...
Well, we kind of already have seen it. I mean, when you think about, I don't know what the number is this year, but it was some 50,000 children or something coming up from Central and South America last year. That I couldn't help but think about climate when that was happening, because what kind of desperation do people need to be into to send their children off across the border unaccompanied?
Right. And I think that to get our heads around this crisis, we just have to think, apply that question to ourselves. How severe would things have to get here for me to send my kids or my loved ones or whoever it is that's near and dear to me away? Because, okay, we have enough resources that you can go, so I'm going to send you. and I'm going to stay here and just try to save the house or something. I mean, how severe would things have to be for us to start making decisions like that? And, you know, those people are in no different situation. You know, they don't want to have to do that. They're not going to do it unless they absolutely have to. But I think that gives us a better idea of how severe this is. So when you look at these refugees, you know, literally sending their families and bodies across, you know, dangerous bodies of waters and overloaded rafts and boats to try to hopefully be able to get on into another country and simply for food and water. I mean, that's extreme, you know, and I think we need to remember that and really remember to humanize it, that, you know, these aren't just numbers. These are people literally running for their lives. And that's already happening right now. And we're going to see it a lot closer to home.
So on a personal level, I mean, I belong to a men's group. And the other evening we were sitting around talking about our worries about climate change, but also recognizing that although I think all of us in that group have put solar arrays on our roofs and put LED bulbs in our fixtures and done various things to conserve, we're also all still flying on airplanes to go and see, like, you know, family members and even recreationally. So we haven't been able to take moderately difficult steps. We've done sort of the easy things because we can afford to. How about you? I mean, what kind of sacrifices are you making?
Well, part of it for me moving here was one of the priorities was to start doing some of what you just described. You know, I live in the county. I run my house on solar. I have a well. I have been busy the last year putting in orchard, berries, greenhouse, getting ready for a garden, chickens, all that too. Consciously made a decision to travel less since I've been here, and I've been doing that and going in that direction more. None of us are pure. None of us can do this perfect. As long as we're driving or flying in jets, you know, we're all hypocrites, and that's just the world that we live in. But we I think are morally obliged to try to do better consistently. And I've done that, and I will continue to do that and have goals, and I'm on track to meeting those goals, but definitely still have a ways to go. And I think that stuff, if we can all start thinking like that and getting things going in that direction, it's going to help. But also, and not to kind of take responsibility off of ourselves, but, you know, we have to remember that the amount of carbon footprint or the size of the carbon footprint that people like you and me and a lot of people in Port Townsend have, you know, this is small change compared to when we talk about the U.S. military, you know, the largest single emitter of carbon emissions on the planet, or some of the other industries.
Do you have a handle on what that is, actually? That's a figure that I've been longing to hear. I mean, like, what is the carbon footprint of the American military?
I don't know it off the top of my head. I used to. I haven't written about it for a while. I will circle back around to that, though, because of this and bring that up, because I will be writing about this more. And it's critically important, you know, because they basically have a free pass and free rein on all environmental regulation and things when you get down to it. And we've seen that here by some of the battles about, you know, their footprint across the Olympic Peninsula, whether it's sound or underwater weapons testing and things like this too. And, you know, I mean, the time of that free pass for the single largest emitter of greenhouse gases on the planet needs to come to a stop, just like it does with, you know, the big oil and the big gas companies that, you know, just free reign to drill at will, given carte blanche politically to do so, supported, you know, across the board politically, whether by Republicans or Democrats, as evidenced by what I mentioned earlier about Obama. But, you know, all that needs to change. I mean, so in concert with what we as individuals are morally obliged to do, again, we're not going to get anywhere as far as having a chance at even mitigating, taking a little bit of the edge off of what's coming, because I think that's best case scenario that we can do at this point. But we have no chance of even doing that unless we can address the military's carbon footprint and big industry carbon footprint, because those are the single largest emitters on the planet, and that's what has to change.
I think we can kind of look at it as a misappropriation of funds for national security to be putting. I mean, I was listening to one of the Growler aircraft flying over just before your arrival here. They're, of course, out there training all the time, and I have no idea, you know, like how many gallons per minute one of those craft burn, but it sounds like a lot when you listen to them. When it comes to considering national security, a huge expenditure for the military as opposed to the same expenditure towards putting solar panels on rooftops? Which do you think we're getting our more value for the dollar?
Well, you know, and I'll probably go on a bit of a tangent here, because if we talk about national security again, beefing up the military, increasing training, increasing the Pentagon's budget, increasing our presence around the globe militarily, it's not going deep enough. I mean, on the one hand, you have the Pentagon's own Quadrennial Defense Review Report, this huge report that comes out every year where they line out, these are what we see as the biggest factors and the things we need to prepare for. And even the Pentagon lists climate change as one of them, because of refugee crises, because of conflicts it's going to generate in other parts of the world that are going to impact Americans abroad and here, all these different factors. And the Pentagon's already well underway in preparing for that. And that's something that's, I think, fun and interesting to point out to people that I think we all know that are in some form of denial about the climate crisis and the humanity's role in it. But if we talk about the national security, again, does it make more sense to just start pouring more money into the military and upgrading training, or look a little bit deeper down into the root causes of the problem, where if it's actually lack of food and water generating political instability around the planet, and that lack of food and water being caused by too much CO2 being emitted into the atmosphere, and the planet becoming too warm, and the climate systems becoming too unstable and unpredictable to support agriculture, as they always have up until fairly recently, then doesn't it make more sense to go down to the root of the problem? Or does it make more sense to just be lazy on, we're going to just take a pass on that and go a little further downstream and address some of the ramifications that are happening later on? I mean, it simply makes a lot more sense to pull the weed out at the roots instead of just like tear the top off, which right now that's what our policy is doing.
Dar Jamal is currently working on a book about anthropogenic climate disruption and files regular dispatches on climate and other topics on the truthout.org website. This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. KPTZ Compass is dedicated to going into the community to bring the stories from the community to the attention of the rest of the community. If you are a community-minded person and consider yourself something of a storyteller besides, perhaps you'd like to join us. We stand ready to train promising people in the subtle arts of radio journalism. If you think this might be the right kind of creative work for you, please stop by the station at the Mountain View Commons to talk with us and fill out a volunteer application. And remember, if you have a news tip or story idea of any kind, send an email to news@kptz.org. That email again for news tips is news@kptz.org. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.